It's Thursday, January 9, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The state of Utah finds itself front and center in terms of the nation's concern about marriage, with several developments over the last several days, even the last several hours, putting that state right in the center of the nation's target of marriage concerns. Yesterday, the governor's office in Utah distributed a statement to the chief of staff, a letter to state cabinet officers, that the state will not recognize the same-sex marriages performed there during the 17 days between the time that a federal judge in Utah ruled that same-sex marriage there must be legal and the United States Supreme Court earlier this week put a hold on that judge's decision. That was 17 days, approximately 1,000 same-sex marriages, and now the state of Utah very carefully says that it is in no position to determine if these marriages are valid or not. That, it says, will be left up to the courts. But at this point, the state says it will not recognize those marriages as valid in terms of state agencies and state programs. But the issue of same-sex marriage is not the only issue squarely in the target on the marriage question in Utah. The other issue, of course, is polygamy. You'll recall that just before the end of the previous year, 2013, a judge in that state ruled that Utah's laws against polygamy were themselves unconstitutional, invading personal privacy and violating the right of people to cohabitate without any reference to marriage whatsoever. The judge did not require the state of Utah to recognize multiple marriages, but rather to allow them. And now, today's edition of the New York Times has a very interesting article on the family at the center of that case, the family known as the Browns, starring in their own reality television program on the TLC network known as Sister Wives. John Schwartz reports, Cody Brown, his four wives and 17 children, want to be the new face of polygamy, what some consider the next frontier after same-sex marriage. Now let's just stop with that opening sentence. That is exactly what many have warned ever since the movement towards the legalization of same-sex marriage began. As a matter of fact, in terms of historical precedent, the shift from monogamy and heterosexual marriage to polygamy is far less of a shift than from monogamous heterosexual marriage to what is now called monogamous homosexual marriage. At least polygamy did not question the basic heterosexual structure of marriage, and there are at least, if sad, historical precedents. But the question of polygamy now before the courts and before the American people is directly tied to the reality of same-sex marriage. By the way, that will factor in this story in the New York Times that appears today. But at this point, it's important to recognize that the warnings about the linkage between same-sex marriage and polygamy were not scare tactics. They were very real. And the judge in the most recent case there in Utah cited the cases related to gay rights, in particular the case Lawrence v. Texas from 2003, in justifying his decision to rule that Utah's statute against polygamy is unconstitutional. Now, remember that just before the end of the 19th century, the federal government required Utah to adopt that legislation as the price of its entry into the Union as a state. You can imagine just what a moral revolution is then encapsulated in the roughly 100-plus years between the entry of Utah into the Union and the reality of same-sex unions, at least as a live debate, even in the state of Utah. But going back to the New York Times article on the Browns, it becomes abundantly clear that the Browns were following a very premeditated strategy. They intended to become the poster children for polygamy, and they also intended to tie their case to the new reality of same-sex marriage. John Schwartz then reports, they promote their family arrangement as part of a growing wave of individual lifestyle choices, managing to anger both the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which abandoned polygamy in 1890, and, to some extent, their own Mormon fundamentalist offshoot, the Apostolic United Brethren, end quote. Now, this is where the story gets really interesting, because, of course, the Browns have managed to offend the Mormon church, the established church, known as the Latter-day Saints, because of their endorsement of polygamy, something that the Mormon church had to give up in terms of the mainstream Mormon church in order for Utah to enter the Union. Now, also, it turns out that the Browns have angered their own offshoot group, identified here as a fundamentalist offshoot group, because they have explicitly tied their cause to that of other new lifestyle choices, including same-sex marriage, which their own church opposes. As John Schwartz reports in this article, quote, as for the Browns' own church, it promotes polygamy but does not condone homosexuality, and its leaders have quietly suggested that they are uncomfortable with the way the decision in the Browns' lawsuit has been held up by some same-sex marriage advocates as supporting the underlying issue of personal privacy, end quote. Well, that's exactly what the judge in this case did, because the attorney for the Browns in this very case made that argument explicitly, and it was the very argument that the court accepted. But at this point, we need to turn to look at a far larger issue, an issue that emerged at the end of last year in an article written by the lead counsel in the Sister Wives case, none other than Jonathan Turley, a professor of law at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. In an article published in December in the Washington Post, Mr. Turley argued that the Sister Wives case, the case he won on behalf of the Browns, spells the end of all morality laws. As he writes, it's true that the Utah ruling is one of the latest examples of a national trend away from laws that impose a moral code. There is a difference, he writes, however, between the demise of morality laws and the demise of morality. This distinction, he says, appears to escape social conservatives nostalgic for a time when the government dictated whom you could live with or sleep with. But the rejection of moral codes is no more a rejection of morality than the rejection of speech codes is a rejection of free speech. Our morality laws are falling, and we are a better nation for it. End quote. That is an astounding, if unsurprising, argument. It's not an argument that's new to Jonathan Turley. Jonathan Turley came on the scene as an advocate for polygamy almost as soon as the Lawrence v. Texas decision was handed down in 2003, dealing with homosexuality. What we're looking at here is a concerted, very sophisticated, libertarian argument. And it is an argument that at face value is likely to get a lot of attention, if not a lot of support, from numerous Americans. Because after all, there are many people who seem to applaud the end of morals legislation. Just a matter of a few months ago, we discussed the fact that the state of Colorado removed crimes such as adultery from the criminal code because, as the state said through its legislature, it is no longer appropriate for the state to try to legislate morality. But before we go any further, let's just draw a clear line in the sand and state this. Every legislature legislates morality. Every code of laws is a codex of morality. The law is itself inherently and inescapably moral. It's irreducibly moral. It can't be anything other than a moral statement. Every system of laws, whether primitive or sophisticated, old or new, whatever the cultural or ethnic or legal context, it is a moral statement. And the removal of morals legislation, as it is called here, and the celebration of that removal is itself a profound moral statement. But it's also a very inconsistent one, as becomes very clear in Jonathan Turley's piece here in the Washington Post. He celebrates the striking down of this law against polygamy. He writes about it as a great moral liberation. He is also, of course, an advocate for the legalization of same-sex marriage. But he's not going to accept every romantic or sexual relationship. Even though he celebrates the end of what he calls morality laws, he wants the law to continue to have sanctions against bestiality and incest. Why bestiality? Well, he says there are obvious consent issues and very real harm. What about incest? He says laws against incest are not morality laws, but rather matters of health. Well, let's look at that for just a moment. That's an argument that's been used before, but it won't hold water. Because what about couples who are beyond the age of childbearing? The medical issues related to incest have to do with a far greater likelihood of genetic abnormalities on the offspring of closely related couples. But if those closely related couples, brother and sister, mother and son, father and daughter, or any kind of permutation thereabouts, if that intimate pair, or to follow Jonathan Turley's logic, a group of more than two, is beyond the age of childbearing and childbearing is no longer a possibility, then what is the medical issue? There obviously isn't one, but you still don't see Mr. Turley advocating the striking down of laws against incest. Why? It is because what he's actually promoting is the progressive striking down of one set of laws and then another. First the laws against same-sex marriage, then the laws against plural marriage. In an amazing sentence, Mr. Turley writes, the case, speaking of the Sister Wives case, was never about the recognition of multiple marriages or the acceptance of the religious values underlying this plural family. It was about the right of consenting adults to make decisions for themselves and their families. End quote. Well, the only reason this was a legal case is because the decisions they were making were decisions about polygamy. He then writes later in the article, quote, "Across the country, the era of morality codes is coming to an inglorious end," end quote. One of the other facets of this article, by the way, is that Jonathan Turley argues that opposition to polygamy is inherently religious or theological. Opposition to polygamy is rooted, he argues, in a religious hatred of polygamy, a Christian hatred in particular. He then celebrates the end of morals legislation, and he talks about the inglorious end of morality laws. But what this really amounts to is the substitution of a morality that is clearly based in the Judeo-Christian heritage and one that is explicitly secular, the secular morality replacing the Christian morality. And there are a good many people, especially in the opinion-shaping class, who believe that escaping a Judeo-Christian morality is exactly what is necessary for the liberation of humanity. You could put Jonathan Turley at the top of that list, and that's why his article in the Washington Post is a very significant challenge to us. The end of morality laws is not just the end of certain laws dealing with certain aspects of morality. It is the trumpeted and celebrated overthrow of Christian morality, at least the influence of Christian morality in the law. And that, we should note, is no small matter. Earlier this week, another very important article on a very important social trend appeared in the Washington Post. Hope Yin writes, "No longer taboo, living together has become a more common arrangement for U.S. couples who become pregnant while dating." She reports on a forthcoming paper to be released by the National Center for Health Statistics, part of the National Centers for Disease Control, that is going to reveal a major cultural shift since the day of what she reminds us were shotgun weddings aimed at avoiding family embarrassment. She then writes, quote, "With marriage on the decline, the shift is helping redefine the traditional notion of family." She then cites Christina Gibson Davis, a sociology professor at Duke University, who said, quote, "The emergence of cohabitation as an acceptable context for childbearing has changed the family formation landscape. Individuals," she says, "still value the idea of a two-parent family, but no longer consider it necessary for the parents to be married," end quote. This is a very interesting and concerning development. It's one that we've been watching for some time as the rates of cohabitation and out-of-wedlock births have both skyrocketed. Cohabitation, recent reports have indicated, is now the first romantic coupling for most young adults. And the majority of young adults who now marry have cohabitated, if not with each other, then with someone else before their marriage. Then when we get to the issue of out-of-wedlock births, the ratio is now 60-40. 60% of babies are still born nationwide to married couples, but the other 40% are not, and that is the growing percentage. The language found in Hope Yen's article is itself very instructive to us, if alarming. She writes, "It's the latest demographic tipping point as cohabitations turn mainstream, a far cry from the days when the father of a pregnant daughter might coerce the baby's father into marriage," end quote. Her use of the phrase demographic tipping point might indicate that this is something that just happened, something like population change. But of course, it isn't something that just happened. This is a momentous change in human morality and human marital patterns, and it is a very ominous one. Demographers say the cohabitating trend among new parents is likely, as she reports, to continue. And a look at this paper, at least in the preview, indicates that the numbers have shocked even those who are accustomed to dealing with these statistics. One of the biggest issues that emerges out of this report is the socioeconomic divide on the issue of marriage, something we've been watching develop for the last several years. As it stands now, college-educated couples are far more likely to get married and to have their children within marriage and to stay married than are lower-income couples. This is a very interesting and fundamentally unexpected development. Over the course of the last several centuries, the people who have been the vast population mainstream have been the people most committed to marriage. But now, the elites appear more committed to marriage than the masses, and that is something that no one seems to have seen coming. Some researchers blame socioeconomic pressures for this phenomenon, but a closer look reveals that the pattern began before the current economic downturn. There are larger economic issues at stake, but far larger than the economic issues are the moral issues at stake, and the effect of this kind of pattern upon children. Even embedded in this article are warnings from those who are citing these statistics that cohabiting couples tend to break up far more frequently than married couples, leaving children of those unions vulnerable. In the last segment, we looked at Jonathan Turley's statement that we should celebrate the end of morality laws and morals legislation. But now in the Washington Post, in this article by Hope Yin, we read this sentence, quote, Social stigma regarding out-of-wedlock births is loosening, and economic factors play a role. Well, in response to that sentence, let's just acknowledge, of course, that economic factors play a role. But those economic factors can't explain the lessening of social stigma, of moral opposition to cohabitation. And, of course, a lessening of social stigma for out-of-wedlock births. They tend to go together, as this research makes absolutely clear. And, of course, speaking of going together, all the stories we've discussed in these segments certainly also go together. There are unifying themes about the secularization of our culture and the revolution in morality we are currently experiencing. None of these things could exist without the others. But finally, a word about the research, the social statistics, and the surveys behind so many of the headlines related to these moral issues. The Los Angeles Times recently reported that many of the statistics on teenage and adolescent homosexuality may be absolutely false, or at least very seriously distorted by teenage jokesters. In other words, these researchers seem to be surprised about something that no parent would be surprised about. It seems that teenagers enjoy pulling the legs of those who ask them questions they don't want to answer. And in the case of researchers who ask these teenagers deeply personal sexual questions, it turns out that a good number of them, even the researchers are now concerned, respond with answers that are made up, imaginary, false, or even intentionally misleading. To be honest, it's hard to take some of these researchers seriously when they seem so surprised about this phenomenon. Many of the researchers cited in this article by Emily Alper-Reyes seem to be absolutely astounded that teenagers would tell them something other than the truth on such interesting and intimate questions. The researchers became concerned when a good percentage of those teenagers who had identified themselves as having some same-sex attraction later turned out to be, by their own reporting, entirely straight. Some of the researchers said, well, maybe these teenagers are simply confused. Maybe they're just confused about how they should respond or confused about their sexual orientation. Then Reyes reports this, quote, others may have answered falsely for fun, one researcher added. Earlier research on the ADD health survey found some signs of dishonesty, the study noted. For instance, and pay close attention to this, for instance, hundreds of teens said they had an artificial hand, arm, leg, or foot, yet few reported the same thing when interviewed at home. The new study found, quote, inconsistent, end quote, boys and girls were more delinquent and more likely to say they weren't honest when they filled out the survey, end quote. Well, you probably won't be surprised to know that by the time you reach the end of this Los Angeles Times article, at least some of the researchers are claiming that the overestimate of gay orientation among youth might actually not be a problem. The problem might be an underestimate, because all of this tomfoolery with the results may indicate that these teenagers actually are reluctant to come out of the closet and say they're gay. My favorite sentence in this article cites one of these researchers, quote, though the new study points to some interesting issues, Meyer said, that's one of the researchers, quote, we don't know what the results would look like if these inconsistent youth were not included, end quote. Well, that's just beautiful. Now you have researchers saying we'll defend our data even if we believe the data to be polluted by inconsistencies, and we don't know what the results would actually look like if we took the inconsistencies out. Well, while you're enjoying that statement, just imagine this. Taxpayers probably paid for that research. Oh, and one last thought and warning. Many of these statistics, even if later proved to be wrong, continue to be cited routinely in the media and in popular culture. Bad research, it turns out, tends to hang around just about as long as good research. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.